had closely paralleled Tolkachev's: the shortages, the dysfunction, the failures of socialism. Fedosayev described it in a book titled Trap, that Rolf now handed to Tolkachev. Sakharov had defected ideologically from the Soviet system. Fedosayev had defected physically. Tolkachev had defected too in his own way, landing hammer blows from within. He thanked Rolf, but his voice trailed off. The hour was late. They shook hands, and he disappeared. At CIA headquarters, a turning point came in early 1981. Reagan entered office determined to ignite a sense of activism and renewed energy in the CIA, an instrument in his larger campaign to aggressively confront the Soviet Union. In a shift from the doubts of the Carter years, Reagan's approach to the world was unapologetically muscular and grounded in a belief in American exceptionalism, that the United States was the last best hope of man on earth, as he often declared. Those who risked their lives for the United States around the globe, sailors, soldiers, aviators, and intelligence officers, carried a special mystique for Reagan. He believed, as the aviation pioneer General James Doolittle had suggested a generation before, that it was worthy to go to almost any length to protect freedom in the face of totalitarianism. To lead the CIA, Reagan chose William J. Casey, a New York lawyer and Republican stalwart who had served in the Office of Strategic Services in London during World War II and been chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the Nixon years. Casey, who served as Reagan's 1980 campaign manager, was a rumpled, slightly stooped figure with wisps of white hair. His speech was often slurred and hard to decipher, but he was possessed of a rigid certainty about what he wanted to do. His appointment signaled a desire for espionage that was more daring and forward-leaning. While Turner had sought to minimize risks, Casey relished taking them. While Turner had distrusted human sources, Casey demanded recruitment of more agents. Casey also shared Reagan's enduring antipathy towards Soviet communism, which dominated his thinking and drove his judgments. On a cold morning in Washington, January 15, 1981, 5 days before Reagan was to take the oath, Turner, the outgoing CIA director, arrived at Blair House, the historic guest quarters across the street from the White House, where Reagan was staying. He was met by Reagan, the Vice President-elect George H.W. Bush, who had been CIA director before Turner and Casey. The occasion was Turner's final intelligence briefing, to share with the new president the nation's most closely guarded and sensitive intelligence secrets. As they sat in a private room, Turner outlined a covert action program in Afghanistan to support the fighters opposing the Soviet occupation. He described how U.S. Navy submarines had secretly tapped Soviet underwater communications cables. These were truly audacious operations. But the jewel of all jewels, he told Reagan, was a human source who worked in a Moscow military research institute. He not only provided hard documentation of Soviet radar and avionics capabilities in the present, but also revealed research and development a decade into the future. His name was Adolf Tolkachev, and his intelligence was worth billions. 2 months later, on March 10, 1981, the beat-up old beige and green Volkswagen van rattled out of the U.S. Embassy compound in Moscow. Once again in disguise, Rolf slipped past the guards. His mission, to meet Tolkachev, was extremely delicate because he was carrying Discus, the CIA's electronic messaging device. Rolf did not want to get caught with it, nor did he want the KGB to ever lay their hands on one. For 50 minutes, he watched for possible surveillance from the van, zigzagging around town. Rolf heard some KGB transmissions on his radio, but they seemed unrelated to him. He then took off the disguise, stepped onto the street, and walked for an hour, listening carefully and watching. No signs of surveillance anywhere. At 9:05 p.m., he arrived at a meeting site, codenamed Anna, located in a park, and spotted Tolkachev, standing at a phone booth. He and Tolkachev began to walk and talk, choosing paths randomly through the park. A few people walking dogs and just strolling saw them, but paid no attention. Rolf informed Tolkachev that the CIA had accepted his plan for the money. It was a deal, no questions asked. Tolkachev seemed satisfied and said no more about it. Tolkachev reported that the CIA's replica of the library permission sheet was excellent. He had already replaced it, but the building pass was still not right. The color of the cover was off. It would not work. The cover and the inside page holding his photograph were made of different materials that the CIA had not adequately replicated. Nor did they properly reproduce the colors of the swirls on the inside paper. Rolf handed Tolkachev another parcel. Inside, he said, you'll find the Elektronia Pribor, the electronic equipment, or the discus. Be very careful, Rolf insisted, and read all the instructions before using it. Rolf repeated, read the instructions, and Tolkachev said he understood. Rolf also emphasized that discus was for use when there was an urgent message that could not wait until their next meeting. He tried to keep the tone upbeat and confident. We want you to use it, he said, perhaps over the summer, when we are not meeting regularly. Rolf did not reveal to Tolkachev that he and Gerber had serious doubts about whether discus would be useful at all. In the Moscow station, one of the most basic principles of espionage was don't ever carry out operational acts without a solid justification. The discus required operational acts. But for what? Tolkachev's great value was in the thousands of documents he copied, not short electronic bursts. As a practical matter, the CIA never had time to train Tolkachev or practice on the device with him. Gerber and Hathaway argued back and forth for months about discus. Hathaway was a headstrong believer. The CIA's prized spy in Warsaw, Richard Kuklinski, was given an earlier version called Iskra. Despite some malfunctions, Kuklinski used it to warn the CIA in January 1981 that plans were being drawn up for the Polish military in the event of martial law. In response, Hathaway sent a congratulatory note to the Warsaw station. I hope this is the first of many, many more to come, he wrote. Later, after a second Kuklinski transmission, headquarters cabled to the Warsaw station that the spy obviously likes his new toy. Hathaway felt that Tolkachev would like it too. The dream, to use technology for covert communications, was broadly shared among operational people at headquarters. They always attempted to push beyond where the KGB might be looking. In covert communications, that sometimes meant deploying an early version of technology, like the discus. The thinking was that the most secret of all technologies is the one that the other person doesn't suspect exists. But Gerber responded that it was never that simple. Moscow case officers were under surveillance far more than in Warsaw. Why scramble a station officer for a message that might say, hello, all is fine? Despite the doubts, the Moscow station complied with Hathaway's request. The discus was now in Tolkachev's hands. Rolf also gave him 42 AA batteries. Tolkachev handed over 55 rolls of 35mm film that he had taken since their last meeting. He told Rolf that he might have only 5 to 10 more rolls by June, and didn't anticipate much production over the summer. With the warm weather, he could not wear the overcoat to hide the documents at lunchtime. He also planned a month-long vacation. Rolf knew that a lot of what Tolkachev planned to steal for the CIA had already been taken, well ahead of his own 7-stage, 12-year schedule. But just as Tolkachev reached this point, the appetite at headquarters was mushrooming. They seemed to want Tolkachev to produce 50 or 100 rolls of film every time. Rolf was irritated at the demands, but could see what was happening. Tolkachev's material was so valuable back at Langley that he was literally paying the rent, justifying the CIA's operational budget, and helping the agency satisfy the military customers. So headquarters was naturally inclined to push the envelope. They asked, "Can he just check out a few more things?" Rolf felt that Tolkachev had single-handedly built a Brooklyn Bridge, and now headquarters wanted him to build a Golden Gate Bridge as well. Still, Rolf carried a letter that had been sent by headquarters with a list of 45 wide-ranging questions about Soviet weapon systems. He gave it to Tolkachev and asked for answers at their next meeting. Tolkachev told Rolf that the concealment for the L-pill, the pen, was just fine and no changes were necessary. Rolf noticed that Tolkachev's greeting had been warmer than before. When they met in the park, they grasped each other's arm firmly. Tolkachev was talkative. All was well with his family and his work, he said. Rolf thought, he may be starting to trust me. Headquarters had instructed Rolf to avoid talking about exfiltration. They wanted to keep Tolkachev in the Soviet Union as long as possible. But Tolkachev would not let go of the idea. In a speculative moment, he came up with a wild, dreamy plan and tried it out on Rolf, who could not quite believe what he was hearing. "Now, if you can have a special airplane that will fly in and pick me up, you could land it in a field someplace in the woods, and we would come running out of the woods and get in the plane and take us out," Tolkachev said. It was totally unrealistic, Rolf thought. This was the Soviet Union, heavily armed. No American spy plane was going to successfully glide onto a field and carry Tolkachev away. But at least Tolkachev was talking to him and showing a human side. Rolf reached into the bag and gave Tolkachev his last parcel, which contained 7 cassettes with the recorded music he had requested. The CIA had bought the cassettes in Eastern Europe, so they could not be traced. Tolkachev was thrilled. They had been talking for only 15 minutes, but to Rolf it had a slow-motion feel, as if they had been chatting for an hour. They agreed to meet again in the autumn, after Tolkachev's summer vacation. Tolkachev gave Rolf a 7-page ops note, handwritten. Once again, Tolkachev slipped away into the darkness, and Rolf returned to the embassy as the shaggy-haired tech in the Volkswagen van passenger seat. The next day, Rolf sent an account of the meeting to headquarters. He felt more than ever that he needed to emphasize how Tolkachev's eyes lit up when he talked about the music, and why that was important for the operation. He wrote that it was truly interesting and revealing how Tolkachev changed from his usual unemotional demeanor when this came up. All of his interest in music is always explained in terms of his son's affinity for it, Rolf reported. Although certainly not to the point of an obsession, his concern over seeing this request through to the end is near paramount. One gets the impression that as a father, he has not always been able to provide everything he might like for his son, and through this channel sees an opportunity to do something very special that he could never otherwise hope to obtain. If the CIA could help Tolkachev with this, Rolf said, there was a chance our stock will rise proportionately in his eyes. Tolkachev was so enthusiastic that he asked the CIA for the English texts of each of the songs contained on the cassettes. Rolf acknowledged, "This is a somewhat unusual request, and certainly unorthodox," but said Tolkachev made it in all seriousness, and there would be little additional risk to carrying it out. In his written ops note, Tolkachev apologized that he could not obtain any more circuit boards or electronic parts from radar equipment. None were available, and even if they were, the risks would be too high. Rolf felt his duty was to explain Tolkachev to headquarters, to be an advocate, just as Gilscher had been. Faced with unceasing demands from headquarters for more production, Rolf wanted to impress upon them that Tolkachev was not a robot with a Pentax camera. He was a man who felt isolated and often needed to let off steam and feel rewarded. On April 2, 1981, Rolf sent an interpretive cable to headquarters. He wrote that Tolkachev displays definite tones of frustration and discouragement when he discusses his personal requests. He added that, in Tolkachev's mind, if the CIA now trusts him with sophisticated technical gear like the miniature Tropel cameras and discus, then We should equally trust him and his sense of responsibility with the items which clearly mean something to him, that is, his personal requests. Those items included the music cassettes and a pair of Western stereo headphones, which Tolkachev had also requested in his ops note. Headphones and music cassettes would not stand out. They could be seen in some Moscow apartments. We have increasingly come to the conclusion that in addition to the get-the-system motivation, CKS is motivated by certain material impulses, and particularly wants to reward his son with some benefits, Rolf wrote. His message, in short, don't quibble over a pair of headphones for the billion-dollar spy. In June 1981, headquarters, ever dreaming that technology would provide the extra edge over the KGB, sent an entirely new communications device to the Moscow station. It was supposedly even better than the Discus, and would finally give the CIA an invisible and secure channel for messages to and from agents. The messaging system would connect directly from a ground transmitter to an American satellite. The Discus was strictly terrestrial. It could work for a few hundred meters from man to man. But the new system, although bulky, could send a message straight from curbside to satellite and directly to the United States. It was based on U.S. Marisat satellites that had been launched in 1976 for ship-to-shore communications. Headquarters sent a cable to the Moscow station, suggesting they give the advanced new device to Tolkachev. The suggestion came just as new reports were arriving about a possible Soviet invasion of Poland. At headquarters, the CIA was seriously worried that a fresh crisis in Poland might lead to a dramatic break in U.S.-Soviet relations, and perhaps an abrupt closure of the Moscow station. How would they maintain contact with Tolkachev? Headquarters insisted that the Moscow station think ahead and be prepared. Gerber believed a break in relations was far-fetched, but he could not ignore the insistent messages from Langley. Gerber's doubts about the new device ran deep, just as they had with the Discus. The whole Tolkachev operation had been geared for the long run, he insisted in a cable to Hathaway. A meeting schedule was already in place for the next 15 months, more than sufficient in the event of tensions or surveillance. Tolkachev was providing intelligence of long-range benefit to our government, and it's not day-to-day intelligence, Gerber added firmly. While we cannot predict there will not be an interruption in station ability to function here that will last longer than a year, there has been nothing we have seen which would indicate that an invasion of Poland would result in the breaking of diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. Privately, Gerber was fuming. He had good personal contacts in Moscow and had been talking to a Polish diplomat. He felt confident the Soviets were not going to invade. But headquarters was pushing him to do something. So on June 24th, the station prepared a contingency plan and a letter for Tolkachev, to be delivered only if events dictated. The plan was to give him the new communications device, just in case. 2 days later, headquarters proposed a major change. Enthusiastic about the new communications device, they suggested that Tolkachev return the Discus and use the satellite system for all communications, in between personal meetings, whether or not station stays or goes. In fact, Tolkachev had not used the Discus once since he first received it. He had not even marked a signal that he wanted to use it. Gerber and Rolf quickly sent a protest back to headquarters. Again, they did not think the station was going to be kicked out of Moscow. They had serious reservations about using the new satellite device for all communications, starting with the fact that there had not yet been a single successful test of the machine from Moscow. Two attempts had failed. Besides, they pointed out, it wasn't simple to get the Discus back. They couldn't very well call the apartment and ask Tolkachev to just bring it to a meeting. Gerber and Rolf were annoyed. They said Tolkachev's silence was probably because he was following to the letter their instructions to use it only for emergencies. Tolkachev is an intelligent and resourceful individual who appreciates the risk involved in frequent contact and unnecessary ops activity, they wrote. He was just being careful. Then, just as suddenly as it appeared, the promise of the new satellite message system vanished. It failed more tests. The Moscow station told headquarters, "We're becoming less optimistic that the machine was right for Tolkachev, not least of the reasons was that it didn't seem to work." When headquarters developed the 55 rolls of film Tolkachev had given Rolf in the park, 6 were blank. It might have been a glitch. Rolf didn't want to bother Tolkachev about it, but made a mental note to bring him a new Pentax camera body at the next meeting. On the remainder of the film, the CIA found sparkling new gems from inside Soviet vaults. 7 rolls of film documented a top-secret surface-to-air missile codenamed Shtora, or blind, as in a window shade, designed to be not detectable by target aircraft because of its advanced and complex jam-proofing and secure operating procedures. Other roles covered topics in computer logic for radar systems and provided the CIA with a set of logs of secret technical reports as they arrived at Tolkachev's institute in 1978, 1979, and 1980, which would allow the Americans to accurately judge the state of Soviet military high technology. The billion-dollar spy had come through again. CIA headquarters dispatched to the Moscow station a pair of German-made stereo headphones, catalogs for stereo systems, and albums by Alice Cooper, Nazareth, and Uriah Heep. Chapter 13. Tormented by the Past. His family and friends called him Adik. His eyes were the color of ash, under a broad forehead and thick brown hair, with a crook in the bridge of his nose from a boyhood hockey accident. He stood about 5 feet 6 inches tall. Tolkachev seemed a quiet fellow to those who knew him. He liked tinkering with electronics and enjoyed building things with his hands, holding a soldering iron or wood plane, fixing a radio, or hammering together a cold frame. Tolkachev was so reserved that he never told his son what he did at work, or took the boy to his office. But inwardly, his mind was not at ease. He was haunted by a dark chapter of Soviet history, and he wanted revenge. Tolkachev was 54 years old in 1981. He suffered from high blood pressure and tried to pay attention to his health, jogging in the spring, summer, and fall, and skiing in the winter. He drank alcohol only rarely. He was usually up before dawn, especially in the long winter, according to letters he wrote to the CIA. Every other day during the week, he got out of bed at 5 a.m. and went for a run outdoors, if it wasn't raining or biting cold. He usually took the main elevator down to the ground floor and pushed open the heavy door onto the tree-lined square, Ploshchad Vostanya, or Square of the Uprising, commemorating the revolts against the Russian Tsar and later the Bolshevik Revolution. Day after day, he ran the same route, first across the square toward the broad boulevard known as the Garden Ring Road, then a right turn toward the U.S. Embassy, past the guard shacks that stood in front of the embassy, then another right turn down a small lane and the spot where 3 years earlier he had handed a letter to Hathaway in the shadow of a small Russian Orthodox church. Tolkachev knew these streets well. He had walked and run them tirelessly in earlier years, searching for cars with license plates indicating they belonged to American diplomats, hoping to drop a note through an open window. In a letter to the CIA, Tolkachev described himself as a morning person. "You probably know," he wrote, "that people are sometimes divided into 2 types of personalities, skylarks and owls. The first have no trouble getting up in the morning, but start getting sleepy as evening approaches. The latter are just the opposite. I belong to the skylarks, my wife and son to the owls." After his jog, Tolkachev said, he usually woke his wife and son and made them breakfast. Natasha, who worked in the antenna department of the institute, was a heavyset woman, and she often left for work before Tolkachev in order to catch the bus. Tolkachev liked to walk to work, through the back streets. Their son was growing fast and stood 5 inches taller than his father. Oleg had not been a rebellious teenager, but his interests ran more toward his mother's side, arts, culture, music, and design, than toward his father's penchant for electronics and engineering. Oleg attended a special school that emphasized English instruction. He was already reading Kipling and Asimov and was consumed with Western rock music. Adik liked his son's music, even if he had only a very weak understanding of English. He was personally fond of jazz, which had been somewhat subversive in Soviet times. Adik tried to bridge the age gap with his teenage son. They went skiing together in the winter, and in the summer months, the family often roughed it on camping trips around the Soviet Union. Once they went to the Baltic Sea, and another year to Lake Valdai. Because he held a security clearance, Tolkachev could not get permission to travel abroad. "I always go with my wife and son," Tolkachev wrote to the CIA of his vacations. "We usually rest in wooded areas on rivers or lakes in a primitive manner, i.e. in camping tent. We cook on a campfire, etc. This year, we also plan to go camping with a tent and backpacks," he added. "I consider that I have the normal attachment to the family that exists in mankind." Tolkachev's imposing apartment building featured a 22-story central tower with a spire flanked by 2 18-floor wings. Those who lived there included Mikhail Gromov, who set a world record flying over the North Pole, Georgi Lobov, a decorated World War II and Korean War fighter ace, and Sergei Anokhin, renowned for his pioneering aviation feats, such as putting a MiG-15 into a supersonic dive. Valentin Glushko, the principal designer of Soviet rocket engines, also lived there, as did Vasily Mishin, who led the Soviet effort, ultimately unsuccessful, to build a lunar rocket. They were the Soviet aviation and missile elite. But Tolkachev was a loner. He had once socialized with workers at his laboratory, he told the CIA. But now, possibly because of age, all these friendly conversations started to tire me, and I have practically ceased such activities. He wrote, "During the past 10 to 15 years, the number of my personal friends has sharply decreased. They are not out of commission, but my contacts with them have become very rare and accidental." Tolkachev's apartment was quite comfortable, with 2 rooms, a small kitchen, a bath, and a toilet. Above the kitchen door was the crawl space, or entresol, which ran 13 feet long and about 3 feet high. In this space, he stored his camping tent, sleeping bags, and building materials, as well as his spy equipment from the CIA. His wife, slightly shorter than Adik, was not agile or tall enough to reach it, and his son had no reason to. Tolkachev kept his tools in the entresol, a gauge for checking current, a soldering iron and wire. For wood projects, he had stowed away his drill, plane, and saw. There were 3 other storage areas in the apartment, all of which he had built. Adik was 30 years old when he married, late for a young Russian man of his generation. His wife was then 22 years old. Tolkachev wrote to the CIA, "I apparently belong to those who love once." Adik and Natasha lived and worked in the closed cocoon of the military-industrial complex, a sprawling archipelago of ministries, institutes, factories, and testing ranges. Tolkachev had the highest-level access to state secrets. Their public behavior was governed by survival in the Soviet party-state system, which dictated conformity. By day, they played by the rules. By night, their private feelings were vastly different. Their thinking was forged in a profound moment of sorrow and loss in Natasha's childhood, during Stalin's purges of 1937, a loss that propelled Adik into the world of espionage. Natasha's father, Ivan Kuzmin, was editor-in-chief of the newspaper Liokaya Industria, or Light Industry. He put a splash of happiness on page one of the paper for New Year's Day 1937, a photograph that might have come from any family, including his own, an outsized image of a beaming mother, arms hoisting high a toddler with an enormous smile and grasping a doll in one hand. A festive New Year's tree stood behind them. The photograph radiates confidence in the future, but it is a posed and artificial buoyancy. The child's arm is outstretched, beckoning like Lenin. It is accompanied by flowery commentary, which declared that the Soviet Union was being directed by the life-giving force of socialism, the Bolshevik Party, and Stalin's genius. The newspaper was the daily chronicle of the textile industry, crammed with material from factory workers, directors, and occasionally Communist Party officials. Much of it was simply letters from worker correspondents, each known as a Robkor, who wrote short bits and pieces about mills and factories, ideas for improved efficiency, and the use of technology and equipment. The front page often featured a large photograph of a young weaver and her success story, how she started her career at a mill, gained experience and skills, and one day suggested and introduced a method that enormously boosted efficiency. The paper printed a mixture of genuine commentary by workers and party exhortations at a time when the Soviet centrally planned economy was in a breakneck phase of industrialization. A headline declared, "It is important to achieve a decisive breakthrough in the implementation of the plan." When a high-ranking party official or minister gave a speech, the paper often published the transcript on page one. Page two carried daily tables of production. How much cotton, flax, hemp, jute, wool, silk, leather, and other materials were produced where. The third page was almost fully devoted to the ideas and suggestions of workers about how to increase production, and the newspaper was expanding its horizons to cover all aspects of light industry. Kuzmin, then 36 years old, never signed articles. He appears to have been more like a moderator among competing voices, selecting the Robkor reports and perhaps writing the unsigned front-page editorials. A member of the Communist Party, he had been editor for 4 years. The paper, created in 1932 in a merger of other publications for textile workers, carried reports and correspondence from all kinds of people, weavers, engineers, and factory directors. But it was still a mouthpiece of the party state. In January 1937, readers could not miss the darkening clouds. The newspaper's front page carried exhaustive coverage of the second of three Moscow show trials. Stalin was brutally snuffing out his rivals one by one, a harbinger of the coming Great Terror. In the first trial, in August 1936, 16 defendants, including the Bolshevik revolutionaries Lev Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev, were accused of disloyalty and conspiring with Stalin's exiled rival, Leon Trotsky. All of the defendants were sentenced to death and shot. The second trial focused on 17 defendants, who were considered lesser leaders of the plot. 13 of them were later executed, and the rest sent to labor camps. Kuzmin's newspaper published all the materials of the second trial, including full transcripts of the interrogations and reactions from readers. "Destroy the villains," one reader wrote. "Shoot the fascist hirelings, despicable traitors. This is the unanimous demand of the working people of the USSR," declared another. When the defendants were convicted on January 30th, the newspaper published the text of the verdict. On February 1st, the newspaper declared that Soviet workers greeted the verdict of the Trotsky gang with deep satisfaction. The truth was far different. Fear by night and a feverish effort by day to pretend enthusiasm for a system of lies was the permanent condition of the Soviet citizen, wrote the historian Robert Conquest. The terror of 1936 through 38 was an almost uniquely devastating blow inflicted by a government on its own population, and the charges against the millions of victims were almost without exception entirely false. Stalin personally ordered, inspired, and organized the operation. On May 1, 1937, the Politburo members who were standing next to Stalin on the reviewing stand for traditional May Day celebrations in Red Square seemed to be unusually nervous, moving uneasily from one foot to the next. The reason for their anxiety? One of them was suddenly missing. Jan Rzutak, a former full member of the Politburo, had disappeared, arrested at a supper party after a theater performance. The secret police detained everyone at the party, too. 3 months later, four of the women were still in prison in their bedraggled evening dresses. After Rzutak's arrest, the next echelon of Moscow's administrative and party elite began to vanish. An atmosphere of fear hung over the party and government offices, Conquest wrote. People disappeared on their way to their jobs in the morning. Every day, another central committee member or vice chairman of a people's commissariat or one of their more important underlings was disappearing. After slicing through the party elite, the purges expanded later in the summer and into the autumn of 1937, wave after wave of suspicion, denunciation, arrest, and execution. One of the largest was the Kulak operation, referring to the more prosperous farmers who had been forced off their land during Stalin's disastrous forced collectivization of agriculture, more than 1.8 million of them sent to prison camps. Now, nearing the end of the standard 8-year term, the Kulaks were soon to return. Stalin feared a wave of disgruntled and embittered people coming home. The hammer fell with a secret police order, number 00447, in July 1937, which set the pattern for the mass killings of the following 2 years. The document ordered arrests by quota, thousands and thousands at a time, in specific categories, such as kulaks, criminals, and other anti-Soviet elements. The categories were so broad as to apply to almost anyone. People were arrested and executed for the slightest indiscretion. So they became extremely guarded in what they said in public. A single stray comment could be reported and lead to arrest, the charges entirely arbitrary. Tens of thousands of people were swept up suddenly for no reason from all walks of life. The NKVD, forerunner to the KGB, divided all suspected enemies of the state into two categories, those who were shot and those who were sent away to the camps for 10 years. This was the biggest of the mass campaigns and accounted for half of all arrests and more than half of all executions. 376,202 persons killed in the 2-year period. The administrative class was sacked, arrested, and executed. In 1937, government ministers, known as commissars, for foreign trade, internal trade, heavy industry, education, justice, sea and river transport, and light industry, were all removed and arrested. There was so much paranoia that anyone who visited or knew someone who lived abroad could be suspect as an enemy of the people. Denunciations were often made recklessly and maliciously and could quickly lead to death. "Today, a man only talks freely with his wife, at night, with the blankets pulled over his head," said the writer Isaac Babel, who himself was arrested in the spring of 1939. Charged with anti-Soviet activity and espionage, and shot in 1940. In 1937, Ivan Kuzmin, the newspaper editor, and his wife Sofia Ifimovna Bamdas lived at 14 Staropinovsky Periulak, a small lane in the heart of Moscow. Their apartment was located half an hour's walk from the Kremlin. Sofia was also a Communist Party member and worked as head of the planning department in the Ministry of the Timber Industry. She was born in 1903 into a bourgeois Jewish family in Kremenchuk, a town on the Dnieper River in the Ukraine, once part of the Jewish Pale of Settlement. The town was known for timber and grain exports. Her father, Efim, had fled to Europe and was prospering as a businessman in Denmark. Efim had two daughters, Sophia and Esfir, both of whom lived in Moscow. Sophia went to visit her father in 1937, and that was the beginning of the end. He was a capitalist and a foreigner, more than enough to generate suspicion. On September 17th, the secret police came to apartment 35. They arrested Sophia, then 34 years old. The charge was that she belonged to a subversive Trotskyist organization in the timber industry. When she was taken away and the door closed, she left behind a daughter, her only child, who was 2 years old. 6 days later, the secret police came for Ivan. He had refused to denounce Sophia. He was not at home. They found him at the apartment of a friend. He was taken to Moscow's notorious Butyrskaya prison and charged with participation in an anti-Soviet terrorist organization. Sophia and Ivan never saw each other again. Her visit to her father in Denmark had prompted someone to denounce her. It is not known who or what was said, but considering that her father was in private business and lived outside the Soviet Union, that was probably sufficient. Her trial was held on December 10, 1937, and she was convicted of subversion. She was executed immediately. The shootings usually took place at night. In a frenzy of terror, vast numbers of people were sentenced each day, sometimes several hundred, and shot. According to Conquest, 2 days after Sophia was executed, on December 12, 1937, Stalin and his premier, Vyacheslav Molotov, approved 3,167 death sentences, and then went to watch a movie. Not all the executions were approved at such a high level. On a day in October, the secret police chief, Nikolai Yezhnov, and another official considered 551 names and sentenced every one of them to be shot. Ivan had been arrested for participation in an anti-Soviet terrorist organization and convicted for sabotage and refusing to inform on others. He steadfastly refused to turn in anyone or to plead guilty. In March 1939, he was sentenced to 10 years in the prison camps, with credit for nearly 2 years already served in jail. He was a son of peasants and was sent to a labor camp in the coal fields of Vorkuta, 1,200 miles from Moscow and 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle. He was held incommunicado, no letters allowed. Their toddler daughter was sent to a state orphanage. So many people had been declared enemies of the people in those years that the orphanages were overflowing. The daughter was fortunate in one respect. Her parents had retained a nanny, whose name was Dunya. Out of compassion, and perhaps fear, Dunya moved with a little girl from institution to institution as she grew up in the years after the arrests and the execution of her mother. In 1947, Ivan was released from the prison camp, but he did not return to Moscow right away. Still fearing arrest, he moved from city to city. Only after Stalin died in 1953 did he feel it was safe to come home and was reunited with his daughter, then 18 years old. They were together only a few years. On March 23, 1955, Ivan Kuzmin was rehabilitated for failure to prove a charge. But he did not live long after that. On December 10, 1956, he died of a brain disease in Moscow. The daughter of Sophia and Ivan, who suffered a childhood without parents because of Stalin's purges, married Adolf Tolkachev the year after her father died. Natalia Ivanova Kuzmina was brimming with strong emotions. She managed to stay out of trouble, but those who worked with her knew of her feelings. She read the band writer Boris Pasternak and the poet Osip Mandelstam. When Alexander Solzhenitsyn's novel, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, was published in 1962 in Novia Mir, a literary journal, she was the first in the family to devour it. Later, When possession of Solzhenitsyn's unpublished works was more dangerous, she was unafraid to pass around copies in Samizdat. In 1968, after the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, there was a rush in Soviet workplaces to pass resolutions supporting the action. She was the only person in her group to vote no. She was, in the words of a supervisor, unable to be insincere. Her long ordeal and her deep antipathy to the Soviet Party state became Tolkachev's, too. Arik was 14 years old the night the German bombers attacked Moscow, July 21, 1941. The city in those years was a tinderbox, largely constructed out of wood, and the German planes dropped 104 tons of high explosive and 46,000 incendiary bombs, killing 130 persons. The first in a wave of aerial bombings that would go on until the following April. The Soviet capital was defended by over 600 large searchlights and 800 anti-aircraft guns, but only primitive radars. The bombing showed how the Soviet Union desperately needed improved radar, and the emerging technology of radar became the central focus of young Tolkachev's career. Adolf Georgievich Tolkachev was born on January 6, 1927, in what was then the Soviet Socialist Kazakh Republic, now Kazakhstan. His family moved to Moscow when he was 2 years old. Little is known about his parents or his brother, who had only a 10th grade education and worked as an electrical mechanic on the railroads. Adik went to a vocational school, the equivalent of a high school, where he studied electronics, finishing in 1948. He then went to the Kharkov Polytechnic Institute in the Ukraine, completing his studies in 1954 in the radio technical department, chiefly about radar. In those days, students had no choice where they would work. Under an assignment system in the centrally planned economy, known as Raspredelenia, they were directed to jobs. Tolkachev was assigned to a military research facility, the Scientific Research Institute for Radio Engineering, known by its Russian acronym, NIIR. It was later given an additional name, Fazotron Scientific Design Association, or simply Fazotron. The institute was made up of 24 structures crowded into a 10-acre compound near the Belorussky train station in Moscow, about 2 miles from the Kremlin. Along the eastern side of the compound, on a narrow lane, Elektrichevskaya Perulak, stood a long row of aging brick buildings, the exteriors decorated with Baroque flourishes from the Russian architecture of the late 1880s. It was in these buildings that the institute had been founded in 1917 to fabricate instruments for aviation, including a simple but reliable device to measure wind speed. After that, the enterprise known as Avia Pribor made watches, thermal instruments, and gramophones. And then, radar. While the bombs were still being dropped by German airplanes in January 1942, the buildings at Elektrichevskaya Periula were given a new name, Factory No. 339, and became the first manufacturing facility for radar in the Soviet Union. In the 1950s, the facility expanded into research and development of military radars, which grew in sophistication from simple sighting devices to complex aviation and weapons guidance systems. It was the only place Tolkachev had ever worked. Fazotron's radars for Soviet warplanes were named Oriol, Smerch, and Sapphire. As in many other areas of technology, the Soviet Union struggled to catch up to the West. In the early 1970s, Soviet airborne radars could not spot moving targets close to the ground, meaning they could fail to detect a terrain-hugging bomber or cruise missile. This vulnerability became a major design challenge for Fazotron. The engineers were pressed to build radars that could look down from above and identify low-flying objects moving against the background of the Earth. The United States was planning to use low-flying, penetrating bombers to attack the Soviet Union in the event of any war. At first, Positron produced an airborne radar known as the RP-23, or Sapphire-23, which provided limited look-down capability for MiG fighters. Then the Institute was ordered to develop a more sophisticated model to be deployed on the MiG-31, a planned supersonic interceptor. But the task proved too difficult for Tolkachev's Institute to complete. By one account, the Institute made lavish claims for a new radar that it simply could not bring to fruition. Despite a wealth of experience, Positron was unable to solve the problem of tracking and destroying a low-flying object against the ground clutter of Earth, nor had it been able to track multiple targets at once. Positron was forced in 1971 to transfer the plans to a competing institute, the Scientific Research Institute of Instrument Engineering, or NIIP. After years of work, the competing institute and several others solved most of the problems in a new radar called Zaslon. Weighing a half ton, it was twice as heavy as the largest airborne U.S. radar, but it worked and carried the first ever Soviet airborne computer. The Zaslon was flight tested for the first time in 1976, and by 1978 had been shown to track 10 targets at once. The first MiG-31 aircraft carrying the Zaslon radar were entering service in the Soviet Air Defense Forces in the autumn of 1981. By that time, Tolkachev had already delivered to the CIA hundreds of pages of blueprints and design specifications of Sapphire-23 and five circuit boards. He gave them plans and drawings of the Zaslon, too. The painful history of the Kuzmin family was passed down to Natasha and to Adik in her father's last years. Ivan told his daughter the unvarnished truth, the terror of the arrests, the finality of the verdicts, the sudden destruction of their family. She learned that Ivan was punished because he stoutly refused to denounce his wife, Sophia. In 1957, the year after Ivan's death, when Adik and Natasha married, the threat of Stalin's mass repressions had passed, but strong memories lingered, and the full scope was only beginning to reveal itself. Khrushchev devoted a speech to Stalin's excesses at the 20th Party Congress on February 25, 1956, blaming Stalin for the unwarranted arrest and execution of party officials during the purges, for the surprise attack on the Soviet Union by Hitler, and for other blunders, although not for the true scope of the repressions or the forced collectivization and famine, calamities for which Khrushchev shared responsibility. Nonetheless, Khrushchev had opened the door. He denounced the cult of personality that had allowed Stalin to amass such raw power. The speech heralded a period of liberalization known as the Thaw, after the title of Ilya Ehrenberg's 1954 novel. Breaking with years of forced adherence to the dictates of socialist realism, some free-thinking writers and artists dared push the boundaries of what was permissible, and hopes ran high that a different country might emerge from the Great Terror and the ravages of war. The Soviet launch of the Sputnik satellite in October 1957 fueled the optimism, especially among young people. Lyudmila Alexeyeva, a historian and human rights champion, recalled that in the years that followed Khrushchev's speech, young men and women began to lose their fear of sharing views, knowledge, beliefs, questions. Every night, we gathered in cramped apartments to recite poetry, read unofficial prose, and swap stories that, taken together, yielded a realistic picture of what was going on in our country. That was the time of our awakening. The awakening undoubtedly swayed Adik and Natasha, too. Tolkachev told the CIA that, in my youth, politics had played a significant role. But he had lost interest and then became scornful of what he called the impassable hypocritical demagoguery of the Soviet Party State. He did not elaborate on this change. But by the mid-1960s, as the thaw was ending and with Khrushchev deposed, Tolkachev seems to have been thinking about how to express his unhappiness. In May 1965, his son Oleg was born. Tolkachev said he did not act at the time because he did not want to endanger his family. "I waited for my son to grow up," he wrote to the CIA of his decision to remain quiet, saying he realized that, in case of a flap, my family would face a severe ordeal. Then, in the years that followed, the mid-1970s, Tolkachev found inspiration in Andrei Sakharov and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, voices of conscience who each waged a titanic struggle against Soviet totalitarianism. Sakharov, like Tolkachev, had a top-secret security clearance, yet he possessed the courage to dissent. Tolkachev did not know him personally, but knew what Sakharov stood for. In the early months of 1968, Andrei Sakharov had worked alone, late into the evening, at his gabled two-story house nestled in the trees at Arzamas 16, the nuclear weapons laboratory, located in the city of Sarov, 230 miles east of Moscow. Sakharov was the principal designer of the Soviet thermonuclear bomb. A pillar of the scientific establishment, who entered the Academy of Sciences in his 30s, he had profound doubts about the moral and ecological consequences of his work, and he played a role in persuading Khrushchev to sign a limited nuclear test ban treaty with the United States in 1963. Now his conscience was calling him again, and would take him well beyond the closed world of Arzamas 16, where he had thrived and been recognized as a brilliant physicist. Each night, from 7 until midnight, alone in the house in the woods, Sakharov worked on an essay about the future of mankind. It became his first significant act of dissent against the Soviet system. Finished in April, the essay was titled Reflections on Progress, Peaceful Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom. Sakharov's mind ranged far and wide, warning that the planet was threatened by thermonuclear war, hunger, ecological catastrophe, and despotism, but he also offered idealistic and utopian ideas to save the world, suggesting that socialism and capitalism could live together. He called it convergence, and the superpowers should not be trying to destroy each other. He wrote candidly of Stalin's crimes. He insisted on a complete de-Stalinization of the country, the end of censorship, release of political prisoners, freedom of opinion, and democratization. The document was startling, visionary, and potentially explosive. Sakharov rewrote and polished his essay, and at one point showed it to Yuli Karitin, the scientific director of the laboratory and a founder of the Soviet nuclear weapons program. The two of them were alone on Karitin's private train. "Well, what did you think?" Sakharov asked Karitin.
"It's awful," Karitin replied.
"The style?"
Sakharov asked. Karitin grimaced.
"No, not the style. It's the content that's awful."
But Sakharov had already begun circulating the essay in carbon copies. Told Karitin he believed everything he had written and could not withdraw it. In July, the manifesto was published abroad, first in a Dutch newspaper and then in the New York Times on July 22nd. The essay also circulated widely in samizdat, hand-to-hand copies inside the Soviet Union. Sakharov was then suspended, effectively fired, from his job at the nuclear weapons laboratory. Only weeks later, on August 20th through the 21st, 1968, Soviet tanks and Warsaw-packed troops crushed the reform movement known as the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. Sakharov had been excited by the democratic experiment. The Soviet crackdown shattered his optimism. "Their hopes inspired by the Prague Spring collapsed," he said. For many, the prospect of any liberalization inside the Soviet Union vanished. The thaw was over. Among those who read Sakharov's reflections in samizdat was Solzhenitsyn, whose trenchant, penetrating novels had depicted the dark corners of Soviet totalitarianism. His novel, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, about the life of a man in the Gulag,